This afternoon, I'm pleased to share with you about Bible land geography. And while I was studying for this class, my mind kept going to Masada. Masada is a mesa on the southwest side of the Dead Sea. Now, we know what a mesa is, right? It has steep sides and a flat top. It was a refuge of last resort for the Romans. They built a cistern inside and had a supply of food in there. In AD 70, when the Romans came and destroyed the temple and Jerusalem, just like Jesus had said would happen, about 1,000 Jews escaped to Masada and locked themselves inside. Now, what was supposed to be for the use of the Romans was being used against the Romans, so needless to say, they were incensed. They took 2 years and 15,000 soldiers to build a ramp up the side of it to get inside. And when they finally got up inside, they found that the people had committed suicide. Only two ladies lived. They had hid themselves to tell the story. Why did I think of this icky story when I thought of Bible land geography? Because how the story unfolded of Masada, which is in the Bible land, how it unfolded depended a lot upon geography. A lot of the stories in Scripture actually unfold in the way they do, in part because of the geography of the land. So if you want to just have a superficial view of Scripture, you might not be interested in geography of the land. But if you want to dig a little deeper and start seeing some connections, the geography of the land could be very helpful for you. So today we're going to do that. What is the definition of geography? One definition I found was, it's the study of the land's features, inhabitants, and phenomena. The study of the land's features, inhabitants, and phenomena. How are we going to do that? We are going to do that by first doing a general overview. We're going to look at the scope of the land. Secondly, we're going to crack open the book of Genesis and look in there a little bit, especially the life of Abraham. Thirdly, we're going to go to the book of Daniel and see some of the geography in Daniel. And just before it degenerates into a prophecy conference, we will be carried away to the headwaters, should I say raptured away, to the headwaters of the Jordan River, and we will make our way down the Jordan River and view the land from there. Finally, if we have time, I hope, we will end in the Greek islands, in Patmos, the island where the end of the world began. So let's begin first with the scope of the land. Just off the top of your head, anybody have an idea what the furthest north, and we're going to exclude the book of Revelation because it's highly speculative. Just in the main part of the Bible, what's the furthest north that the Bible talks about? Any ideas? It's okay if you don't know, that's why you took the class, right? But I just wanted to see. So it would be either Pontus here in Turkey, which is Asia Minor, and possibly Rome. So Rome and Pontus are about the same distance from the equator. And Turkey, modern Turkey here, is called Asia Minor. And I would just like to briefly say that for years, the Bible talks about the Hittites, right? For years, they said, oh, the Hittites, the Bible's wrong. It's not true. We don't have any evidence that they existed. Then, we made a mistake. They found that the Hittites were a huge civilization in Turkey. So never bet against the Bible, you'll always be wrong. What about furthest west? Any idea furthest west? Spain. Or maybe, this is going to be a problem, this recording I can see here, I'll use this stick. Maybe Gibraltar here, because some people think that that is where Jonah was trying to flee to. Gibraltar is like a city at the foot of this giant hilly rock. And it's right between the Mediterranean Sea, where the Mediterranean Sea meets the Atlantic Ocean in the bottom of Spain there. All right, so what about the furthest south? I'm going to stop asking. So the furthest south would be Kush. Now, what's Kush? Well, Kush is like Ethiopia, but it also started to mean just anything further south than Israel. The furthest east was India. Now, let's talk about some of the main features of the land. Well, of course, it would be silly not to mention the Mediterranean, right? The Mediterranean Sea right here. It's one of the main features of the land. It creates its own little climate. It allows weather masses to freely move throughout this region, creating a sort of even climate. And The person who named it was not extremely creative. It's called a Mediterranean climate. And it is similar to, I don't know, aren't any of you guys from California? It would be similar to like Sacramento area, but it's more humid there. It's very humid in the summer sometimes. So this sea here facilitated the free trade and spread of ideas of people. So the three Abrahamic religions easily spread here. We have Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, of course. Also, the spread of cultures. This was a perfect place, of course, for God to have his people, right? Because it could easily spread to Asia, Africa, and Europe. Speaking of ideas and culture spreading, I have some lovely assistants here who will hand out some baklava if you want to eat some. That's common in the region. And different countries claim that it originated in their country. Now this baklava, I would use the wrapper to eat it, or you could save it to later, whatever you want. Just, yeah, hand it out. Anybody who wants some. It's really sticky, but here's the deal with it. I made it with pine honey from Greece. Exactly how bees make pine honey when they don't have a regular flower will only be divulged later after you have eaten it. But I will say that I did eat some. I did eat some, so it's not poisonous. Okay. Well, what's the highest place? The highest place are the mountains of Ararat on the border between Turkey and Armenia. It's actually not in Armenia, but it's close to Armenia. Interestingly enough, the Armenians love the mountains of Ararat so much they actually have it on the shield, the official shield for the country, which you can see over there, and I think it's kind of cute. So they got the mountains of Ararat, and then on the top they have Noah's Ark. Now that mountain is 16,834 feet, and just so you can compare that to something around here, Mount Hood is 11,000 feet. So it's a pretty tall mountain. And of course, you know what happened there, right? Noah's Ark went there. The lowest place, you could guess this one, the Dead Sea, right? Because it's the lowest place in the world at -1,410. All right, so we've had just kind of a general overview. I would like to say that before we go to the book of Genesis, because we're not going to come back to this region of the Mediterranean, I want to mention the Isle of Malta, which is about 114 miles south of Sicily here. You know that the Apostle Paul crashed there, right? So you can go visit the beach he crashed on. They know which beach it was. And to this day, because of that little accident that they had there, 95% of the people of the island claim to be Christians. And you say, well, they're not all Christians or whatever. Okay, well, maybe not. But 2,000 years later, people are still influenced by a little visit of this old man. Think about your life and how God could use it. God can use your life in amazing ways. Maybe thousands of years from now, people's lives will be changed because they had you as a teacher or something. Or maybe your car crashed somewhere or something. You never know. All right. So we read in Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We're very familiar with that passage. So we know that geography originated from God, right? That's simple. But here's the thing. When Moses wrote that, that was not the common view. That's not what he learned in school. He went to public school, so to speak. And there he would have learned that in the primeval ocean, this egg self-generated, not much different than the egg is today, this egg self-generated, and out of the egg hatched the sun god. Then the sun god had four children. I don't know where they came from, but sure, four children. I'm just going with it. And these four children started fighting. And then everything in creation is a product of their fights. Moses did not go with what was going on at the time, what the people liked. He went with the truth. And because of that, we're still studying his writings to this day. Stick with the truth. Now, the Garden of Eden. First of all, people would argue, they'll say, you can't know where the Garden of Eden is. Okay, so A, I don't really care where the Garden of Eden is. I just don't. But B, I have to prove the naysayers wrong. So yes, you can't know exactly where it was. But Moses did tell us where it was. Moses wrote about it. Adam didn't write about it. Moses said, you know the Tigris and Euphrates River? Yeah, their headwaters, that's in Eden. That's where the garden was. So let's follow it back. Here's the Tigris and Euphrates River in Iraq. Here we go. Up, 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 up. I think you have this map in your pack. By the way, up, up, up. Oh no, it's getting further apart. The people that say the Bible is wrong are right. Oh no. Oh, oh. And then it starts coming back together. And right about here in this area, these are rivers that hook to it. The headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates River are separated by only 40 miles today. Just 40 miles. My house is further away than that. So, the Garden of Eden was somewhere here in this area in Turkey. Now, yes, the Tigris and Euphrates River do move around a little bit down here. But up here in Turkey, the rivers are actually in places embedded in rocks. So it's basically a permanent riverbed. So they don't move as much. All right, well, let's go on. Abraham, when he came into the land, he would have come down from the north into the country. If you look at this map right here, he started in the land of Ur, or the city of Ur, in the land of Sumer. And what Sumer is Sumer is a region of Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is near the Tigris, or in between the Tigris and Euphrates River, and right around that area. So God called him out, and if you read the Bible, I found this kind of interesting and ironic. The promised land was supposed to go from the Mediterranean Sea to the Euphrates River, and that's where Abraham already lived. So I find it ironic he had to leave to go to the promised land. But God did take him to where his descendants actually would live, even though, because this wasn't realized, of course, even though it was promised to them. It was never realized because of their rebellion. He actually then moved to where his descendants would live in reality. And he stuck to the coastal areas here in the mountains. He didn't go inland to like the Jordan or the Dead Sea, at least that I have record of. He died here near Hebron. And you can actually go visit his tomb if you can get in, if they'll let you in, it's there. All right. When he was in the plains of Mamre, which is by Hebron, three visitors came to him, which you know about, right? One of them was God, and there was two angels. And they warned him about what was going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, I read an interesting article in the Smithsonian magazine. And the Smithsonian, as you know, is not a Christian magazine. They're not trying to push Christian beliefs. It's like atheistic. But they reported some very interesting findings of some cities right where Sodom and Gomorrah would have been. Listen to what happened when they investigated these ruins. This is what they say about it. Okay, and keep in mind, these are atheists. They attribute the damage to an airburst created when a meteor or comet traveled through the atmosphere at a high speed. It would have exploded 2.5 miles above the city in a blast 1,000 times more powerful than an atomic bomb used at Hiroshima. A shockwave ripped through the city at 740 miles per hour. The city's buildings were reduced to foundation and rubble. Their bodies were torn apart and their bones blasted into small fragments. And in Genesis 19:4, it says that when Lot tried to warn people about it, it appeared to them that he was just joking. He was just joking. And that's like the world today. The Bible's just a joke, right? It wasn't funny what happened. They found pot shards that had melted on the outside and were turned to glass while the inside was still clay. Here, I told a friend of mine, a chemist, that I was doing this report. So he said, well, I have some sulfur that I got from the cities. And of course, I wanted it. He gave it to me. And you can look at it too after this class. This larger piece of sulfur here has some ash embedded into it. And he said, that was probably a house, a tree, or a person or something. So you can look at this after if you want to. He said, normally sulfur is yellow. Elemental sulfur is yellow. But this had been exposed to so much heat, he said it caused the atoms to arrange in a different format, and so it's actually white. All right, let's move on from Abraham. Let's go to the book of Daniel. Probably not going to stay there, but that I don't care. The book of Daniel creates The book of Daniel creates a problem for people who do not believe in the supernatural. Because Daniel, Daniel foretold the future very clearly. And so these atheists or whatever, they have to argue that the book of Daniel was written after the events happened. But now that creates a problem, right? Because Jesus refers to the book of Daniel in his day, and some of the things that were fulfilled in Jesus' day. So that's nonsense. I'm going to read for you from Daniel chapter 9. And I would like you to think in your mind, who is this person that it's talking about? Who is this person that died before the temple and the city were destroyed? I'll just let you ponder it. Verse 25. From the issuing of a decree to rebuild and restore Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. 7 plus 62 is 69. 69 units is 7. So 69 times 7 is 483. Now you say, how do you know it's not literal days instead of years? Because I think Daniel is smart enough to know that the temple could not be rebuilt and the Messiah come within a 483 day time frame, right? It took years to rebuild the temple. So most people interpret this as years. So I might lose you, that's okay. 483 years. Well, in Nehemiah chapter 2, a decree was issued by Artaxerxes in the 20th year of his reign, which according to the Encyclopedia Britannica would have been 465 BC. If you take 465 BC minus 483, you get AD 18, which is during Jesus' lifespan. Now, it gets a little complicated because what calendar did Gabriel use? Did he use a lunar calendar of 354 days to a year? What did he use? But whether you use the 354, 365, or something like that, it still comes out to the very beginnings of the first century during Jesus' lifespan. So who is this person? Let's keep going. So this person that comes in the beginning of the first century. Verse 26. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the coming prince will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So this person comes before the city and the sanctuary are destroyed. Verse 27, and he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offerings. The Romans had peace agreements with the Jews for longer than the 7 year period. I get that. But Gabriel's breaking things down into 7 year fragments. And a seven-year fragment, halfway through, the sacrifices and offerings would end. The Jewish revolt lasted 4.5 years, approximately halfway through a seven-year period, at the end of which the temple was destroyed, and so was Jerusalem. So who was this person? Well, it was Jesus. Now, people who do not believe in God, or maybe Jewish people, because this is in their scripture, they try to say, well, it was a certain high priest that died or something. All right, I'll let you decide if you're convinced by that. All right, so this chart. Daniel has visions and dreams, or interprets a vision in chapter 2. Then he has visions and dreams in chapter 7, 8, and 11 and 12. The kingdoms that come after Babylon are, just historically, I'm just going to do this historically, Medo-Persia, and then after Medo-Persia is Greece, historically, okay, Greece right here. They rule the area that would be pertinent to the Jews. And then after Greece, the Seleucids would rule. The Seleucids are Syria. Okay? So that, I think that's what these four kingdoms are. You get four kingdoms in chapter 2. You get four kingdoms in chapter 7. You get three kingdoms in chapter 8. It dropped one. And chapter 11 and 12, it dropped one. Okay? I would point out that in chapter 11, Babylon had already fallen to the Medes and Persians, so it wouldn't be pertinent anymore. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through this for you. I'm going to focus a little bit on something you might find interesting. The history of Antiochus and what he did to the Jews. And let's just see if it matches what it says in Daniel chapter 11. I'm going to start at verse 20. That's where it says. And just for context, this is right after Greece splits into four parts. So Greece splits into four parts. Alexander the Great dies, right? If you know your history. And he has four generals. And one general takes Syria. One general takes Egypt. And there's two other generals that are not pertinent to our discussion. All right, verse 20. Then in his place, one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. All right, so this king, Helodius, took charge of Syria. And then he sent somebody to the temple in Jerusalem to take the treasures out of Jerusalem, to collect the treasures. Something stopped him from being able to take the treasures. We don't know what it is. If you read the book of one of the books of Maccabees, we learn that it was an angel that stopped him. But we don't have that in general history. Something stopped him. Then while Helodius was here in Syria, Antiochus comes back to Syria, and he convinces the ruling class that he should be king instead. So they oust Helodius. He becomes king. He's not supposed to be the next king. The next king is actually a captive of Rome. There's another person in line to become king, but he's just a boy. So Antiochus marries the boy's mom, okay, so he could have control of the boy. Then the boy mysteriously dies. Mysteriously, in quotes, dies. So Antiochus ends up being the 11th ruler after supplanting three rulers. And if you go back to Daniel chapter 7, you'll see that one of the horns on the beast that had 10 supplanted three. Okay? And he was the 11th. Now let's keep reading. Verse 22. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. So they had Syria had an agreement with Egypt, a peaceful arrangement. But Egypt rebelled. So the king of Syria marched down. And he got rid of the prince that was ruling there that they had the arrangement with. Seems to fit the text to me. And he installed a puppet king. Then verse 28. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. All right, so when Antiochus went back up to Syria, he installed a new high priest, an illegitimate high priest named Jason. Jason gave him money. And Jason's job was to Hellenize the Jews. So he built this like gymnasium thing right next to the temple. In order to go inside, you had to be naked. Okay? So this is not about morality or anything like that. And as the records go, the priests started neglecting the duties in the temple because they wanted to get to the gym. They wanted to get to the gym in time for the discus throwing. All right? I think there's some parallels today, but I'll let you think about that. Anyway, he goes back home. Antiochus goes back home to Syria right here, which you know where Syria is now, I hope. At the appointed time, he will return and come south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. Okay? So if we look at history, what happened? Well, Egypt rebelled again. So Antiochus marched back down through Israel into Egypt. And again, he had success. It was going great for him. Until he got to Alexandria, Egypt. And then something interesting happened. This delegate from Rome approached him with a group of delegates. He greeted them. And then Gaius says to him, "I'm sorry, but you need to withdraw from Egypt." His response is, it reminds me of a student. Okay, I'll let you think about this. "I'll think about it." That's what he said. To which Gaius took his stick, his walking stick, and drew a circle around Antiochus and said something to the effect of, "If you leave this circle before agreeing to peacefully withdraw from Egypt and Cyprus, we're going to need a body bag." So Antiochus, you know, and by the way, he took on the name Epiphanes, which means God manifest. So, quote unquote, God manifest, has to withdraw. He goes up back into Israel, and he's in a very, very bad mood. Let's see what happens. "Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary." This is verse 31. "And do away with regular sacrifice. They will set up an abomination of desolation." All right? So there was an abomination of desolation in chapter 9, which I think is the one Jesus is talking about. I think this one's a different one. So Antiochus put a statue of Zeus up in the temple. He stopped the sacrifice and offerings to God. He required them to offer pig's blood and pigs. He required them to eat pork. He told the Jews, "You need to give up all your scriptures, all your holy scriptures. You need to give up all your Jewish practices. You need to eat pork. You need to be Hellenized. And if you don't do those things, I'm going to kill you." And he did. He killed. There's stories, the people he killed. He's like, "You have to eat pork." And they're like, "We're not going to do it." So these people died. It all went well until, well in a relative term, well for Antiochus' plans. It all went well until he came to this village where this old guy lived. Now, this is the Old Covenant, so is it okay if I get excited about violence if it's in the Old Covenant? I don't know. I don't know. But Mattathias, so they went over to Mattathias, and they told him, "All right, do the sacrifice right here in front of us. Show us that you're committed to the Greek culture." He wouldn't do it. So he stepped aside, and another Jew came running up. And he was going to do the sacrifice. So this old guy, Mattathias, kills the Jew, the compromising Jew, and then he kills the soldier. Bizarre. And he starts this revolt. His younger son, Judas, takes over the revolt, and the people nicknamed him the Hammer, which is Maccabee in their language, thus starting what would be called the Maccabean Revolt. Now, this Maccabean Revolt was successful. So what they tried to do, they tried to stomp out God's people. They tried to get rid of the scriptures, get rid of the Jewish practices. But instead, by Antiochus doing this, it actually saved them. The people rallied behind the Maccabees. And a little over 3 years after the temple had been desecrated, it was restored and put into the practice of worshiping God again. I don't know if you know anything about Jewish holidays, but the holiday they celebrate is called Hanukkah. In the Gospels, it's called the Feast of the Dedication. Anyway, in our texts, And I'm almost done with Daniel, don't worry. In our texts, you can see in chapter 7, how long were these bad things supposed to happen? For 3.5 years. Exactly. In chapter 8 of Daniel, how long were these bad things supposed to happen? The sacrifices were supposed to stop? For 2,300 evenings and mornings. Well, in other versions, or in other versions it says 2,300 evenings and mornings, but in the King James it says 2,300 days. Because they thought 2,300 evenings and mornings is 2,300 days. But if I asked you, how many trucks and cars do you have, and you said 3, would I think you have 3 cars and 3 trucks? Or would I think you would have, if you added them together, you'd have 3? And so 2,300 evenings and mornings, there's one evening and one morning every day. So if you take it as 2 a day, then guess what? It's just a little over 3 years. And then in Daniel chapter 11, same thing. Just a little over 3.5 years. I'll let you decide if these are close enough to be the same event. I'll let you think about it. I think that it is. But let's go on. I want to go to the Jordan River and take a trip down that. Let's see here. Before we start heading down the river, I want to tell you that Israel is about the size of Vermont. Its borders to the north are Lebanon. Of course, we've got the Mediterranean Sea to the west. We have Syria to the northeast. We have Jordan. We have Egypt in the south, and we also have the Gulf of Aqaba in the south. You can see that on this map. Israel kind of forms a V and then it goes way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is actually a part of the Red Sea. It's just a finger of the Red Sea, not far from Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments. The country is about 236 miles long and 71 miles wide at its widest point. In Oregon, we have around 50 people per square mile. But in Israel, they have over 1,000 people per square mile. And so a lot of the people actually have to live in apartments. They have a nice life. Their average income is $50,000 a year. Ours in the United States is like $70,000, so it's not much of a difference. They in fact live 4 years longer than us on average. As we go down the Jordan River, we're going to talk about 4 different regions the country is divided into. So there's the coastal plain, where half of the people live. Half of the people of Israel prefer to live in the coastal plain area. There's the hills in the north and central part. There's the Jordan River Valley, and something I want you to remember is its average width is only 6 miles. Now, the Willamette Valley at its widest point is like 60 miles. So could you imagine this, all these stories we hear happening in the Jordan River and stuff, it's a valley about 6 miles wide, not very wide. And then finally, the final region is the Negev, which is in the south, is a desert region. What does it look like there? Well, it looks a lot like around here. There's patches of pine trees and oak trees and then dry grassy areas. They also have eucalyptus because it's a Mediterranean climate. It's a little milder than here. And you'll see, of course, olive orchards, vineyards. There'd be even citrus groves and things like that. What's the highest place in Israel? Does anyone know the highest place? Can anyone guess? Yes, Mount Hermon. I have a picture. Where are you? Oh, see those geese over there? That's taken from Lake Hula. And that's Mount Hermon in the background at 9,232 feet. And remember, Mount Hood is like a little over 11,000, so that gives you an idea. The Jordan River goes for 124 miles to the Dead Sea, but it curves and twists so much, so it's actually way more than that. How does the Jordan River start? It starts near Mount Hermon. 3 rivers converge in the Hula Valley. One of them is the Banias, which I should have a picture. Where are you, Banias? Oh, there's a waterfall there. So these rivers, they get their water from Mount Hermon. And they're fast flowing and clean to start with. They come together here near Dan in northern Israel. And interestingly enough, Dan is where that golden calf by Jeroboam was put. He's like, it's too hard for you to go to the temple. Okay, so he put that calf there. He also put a calf here in Bethel. So you could see he was just trying to make it convenient and keep people from going to the temple. But anyway, so the three rivers converge. They go by Lake Hula. When people think of the Holy Land, they only think of the Sea of Galilee, right? But actually, there's another lake, Lake Hula. That one used to be all marshy, and so they drained it because it was spreading malaria. But it caused problems with water quality. It caused problems with flooding, so they built a small version of it again. Anyway, so here's Mount Hula in the Hula Valley, and then we're going to go down into the Sea of Galilee. The lake is the lowest freshwater lake in the world at negative 695 feet. It's 13 miles long and 8 miles wide. Something people do not know about the Sea of Galilee is there's actually saltwater springs underneath it. So the only thing that keeps it fresh is like the weight of the freshwater on top. And if it gets too low, the salt would mix and it would destroy the lake. So they put a dam actually in the bottom of the sea to try to control that. Not the bottom of it, but bottom edge. I don't want to confuse anybody. You know what I mean. The Beatitudes were on the northwest part of the lake, on the Mount of Beatitudes, and this gives me a kick. This should be a riddle. What mountain is below sea level? It's a mountain, but it's actually negative 226 feet below sea level. Well, a hill. It's really a hill. So it's a mountain, but it's actually lower than the ocean. All right, Canaan is where his first miracle happened. It's northwest of Nazareth, which you see right here. And Jesus, of course, came from Nazareth. He moved to Capernaum for a while. Of course, he's moving all over, so I'm not going to do each step or we're going to be in trouble. There's Capernaum there. And I want to point out that I used to think before I did this report that the Galilee was all the way around the lake. That's not true. It's a region that goes out here to the west side of the lake. So when it says that he sailed to the opposite side of Galilee, he sailed over here to the east side. And remember what happened when he got there? He's just trying to do God's, work. He needs a break, right? He gets over there and the devil throws out the welcome wagon, right? It's like the worst person ever meets him. A demon-possessed guy with a legion of demons. Anyway, Jesus could handle it. But that was on the eastern side where like Jordan is today. All right. Then there's the Jezreel Valley up here by Nazareth. It's southwest of Nazareth, and that's where Gideon beat the Midianites, Saul lost to the Philistines, and it's also mentioned in the book of Revelation. Mount Carmel at 1,791 feet out here by the coast actually has some caves. So if you visit Israel, check out those caves. Interesting caves with artifacts inside. But Elijah confronted the false prophets there. Before we go any further south, I would like to point out that Jesus actually went to the region of Tyre and Sidon, it says in the scriptures, which are part of Lebanon to this day. It said he went to the coast. So Jesus liked to go to the beach too, at least that one time. And I didn't realize he went that far north. All right, so after the Sea of Galilee, at first the Jordan River will be flowing quickly. But then, after a few miles, they start putting sewage, raw sewage, into it, and it starts moving sluggishly. So was it Naaman that didn't want to bathe in it? I could see why Naaman wasn't super, at least today, why he wouldn't be super into it. It's full of sewage. All right, as we go south, we'll see Mount Tabor. That's considered the Mount of Transfiguration at 1,886. You can see it here on this map. Keep this map, because it'll help you keep track of these places when you're reading the Bible. Out at the coast, you'll see Caesarea, where Paul was taken to escape from the Jews in Jerusalem. Mount Gilboa here, as we're still going south, is where Saul died. Samaria is where where Ahab and Jezebel lived. And interestingly enough, did you know this? Also, Elijah the prophet lived there. And Elijah the prophet was a prophet for 6 decades. Out at the coast is Jaffa, which used to be called Joppa. That's where Jonah went, of course, to take the boat to the far side of the sea. Jericho here, around Jericho is where Jesus was baptized. He was actually baptized on the Jordan side of the river. I just want to tell you that on behalf of the Jordan Tourist Department. But supposedly, Elijah caused the axe head to float in the same area, and the Jews, when they came into the land, crossed, supposedly at the same place that Jesus was baptized. I can't prove that it is, but at least it's in that area. Mount Nebo, right here on the eastern side of the sea, of course, is where Moses was taken to heaven. And Mount Nebo, where are you, Mount Nebo? Right here. 2,651 feet. And at the top of Mount Nebo, they have that interesting sculpture there, which is a kind of a mixture. An artist put it there. It's a mixture of the cross and of the serpent on the pole that the Israelites were to look at to be saved. Mount Zion, 2,428 feet. It was also called Salem in Scripture. And the Jebusites had taken it over. Remember that Melchizedek lived in Salem. So Melchizedek lived in Jerusalem. All right? So when you read the Scripture, it's the same city. The Jebusites took it over and called it Jebus. And then David took it over again, and it was named Jerusalem. And that's where the Temple Mount is, which is called Mount Moriah. And the Dome of the Rock is there. And you can see a picture of the Dome of the Rock here. That is where the Muslims say Muhammad went up into heaven to talk to God. All right, the Dead Sea Scrolls are here by the Dead Sea. And I'm just going to wrap this up. So I'm going to skip some things here. But we're going to go to the Greek Isles. And I'm going to stop at Icaria first. So to see this picture of this old man here. His name is Timaeus, and he was dying. He moved from Icaria when he was a boy to the United States. Then when he got to be 65, this is in the Greek island of Icaria, okay? When he got to be 65, he developed lung cancer. Multiple doctors said, soon you're going to die. So he decided, I'm going to move back to Icaria to die because it costs about $200 for a funeral. He moved back there. The people there, all they eat pretty much is vegetables. They like vegetable pie. They even dry their zucchini for the winter, which if that's longevity food, I'm not going to make it. But he was so sick, he stayed in bed. But after a little while, he gained his strength. And he lived 40 more years. So the people on the island are in a region called a blue zone, where the people live unusually long. That island, Icaria, is just a few miles north. Just a few miles north of... Is that it? About 22 miles north of Patmos. And in Patmos, of course, the Apostle John, according to the people of the island, was suffering the fate of being trapped 18 months on a sunny Greek island. With that, I'm going to conclude, and I'll tell you how pine honey is made. So, in certain regions like Greece where there's pine trees, but there's not regular flowers, some insects start eating off the trees. And these insects eat. And then they, should I say, uneat. And then bees go and they collect this uneaten stuff and they make honey out of it. I hope you enjoyed it. That's the end of my talk.